Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities on WICC 600.
Good Lord, do I love this topic. Oh, joining me this morning is Spencer Hill with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Good morning, Spencer. We're talking about media bias. Oh,
yes. Good morning. Thank you for having me again.
Good Lord. No, it's no problem. The reason I'm so passionate about this is because it actually kind of saddens me. I've got to be honest with you, Spence. When I first decided I wanted to be a reporter, it was years ago, but it was during a time where you watched the news, you got the facts, and you moved on with your life. You know, you watched the 6 o'clock news,
yep.
you learned the stories, and you moved on. And maybe you talked about it around the dinner table or whatever. But we have become this format of news, the kind of news that we do here on WICC in the mornings. It's kind of more rare. You might find it in more local news, but
yeah. National
news, network news, it's very opinionated. That's more of the basis, is this is how I feel, and let me support telling you why I feel this way. And unfortunately,
yeah. That's
why you've got such a divided nation. There are many reasons, but to me, I think the media plays a big role in why people feel so strongly about something and feel so strongly about the other side of that argument. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, media coverage kind of shapes how we see the world. It shapes kind of our perceptions of not only what is going on, but what are the things we need to be looking out for. And even when you're kind of done reading the news story, that the way the kind of media can frame things is going to stay with you throughout your day and just influence just kind of everything as you're going about the world. So it's incredibly important that we kind of look at how the world is being covered by the media.
Mm-hmm. It's also very manipulative.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's what drives me the most crazy, to be honest, because I can hear my mind, because I've been, you know, I'll call it classically trained in journalism, I can tell when you have an opinionated, you know, piece of journalism versus something that is just cold, hard facts. It's so obvious to me, but unfortunately, the average person will watch the news and will not pick up on the fact that 90%+ of that broadcast was all opinionated. And while there are facts maybe drawing those opinions, all you got from that was someone's very strong opinions, and either they convinced you or they didn't. Like, I feel like I'm in a courtroom. You know what I mean? I watch the news and I think I'm in a courtroom, like, oh, who made the better testimony here? And that's what I'm going to go with versus what are the facts in this story?
Yeah, that, and you're so right, because so much of our media landscape has become kind of partisan, and it is so opinionated, where people will, we talk about the news in left wing and right wing, and you shouldn't be able to say kind of where someone got their news from by the facts that they're conveying.
Yes.
But you often can, because again, what people are saying is so colored by kind of all of their beliefs, whether unconscious or subconscious, or conscious or unconscious, I should say. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so how has that impacted the work that you guys do, for example?
Yeah. So what I really wanted to kind of focus on is kind of depictions of crime in the media, because this is where we see a great deal of studied bias in reporting and how that bias kind of impacts everything else. So, for example, when we are looking at coverage of a crime, when it is committed by a Black person, mugshots are used in 45% of the cases of media coverage of that crime. For the same crime, so, you know, the same severity, same general circumstances, only 8% of white defendants have their mugshot used. So the impression taken away is, mugshots, that is a person who's guilty already. They are a threat, whereas you just don't get that same for white defendants. Same thing with pictures of white victims. They are nearly four times more likely to be seen in photos with friends and family than Black victims. So again, it just spins this narrative, and the average person who's kind of seeing this has no idea that even just the pictures that they're seeing are giving this narrative, and that is going to impact how they kind of react to the story and how they react to the people that they see on the street.
Wow. One of the kind of, I just think those are very jarring percentages. That's a lot to digest. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it gets even worse because there was a recent study by the Equal Justice Initiative that found that they did an analysis of the words used to describe defendants. So for white defendants, the top three terms were man, son, and father. For black defendants, the top three terms were murder, accused, and arrested. So again, even just the language used is giving this narrative, and it's entirely kind of something that you may not even be aware that you're kind of picking up on that narrative, and it just kind of goes on and on, where we see just over and over again that the way people are treated and covered in the media is not the same. It's not just black men.
I was going to say, I find that really interesting. We're talking to Spencer Hill this morning of the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. I find it really interesting because we're so hyper-focused and we're also living in a very, I'm going to call it like a woke generation, a very cancel culture generation. Like, I find that very shocking because, and I'm not saying that your facts are incorrect, I mean, you have plain data showing that. And I'm just wondering what made that shift. Because as I mentioned, when I was learning how to write news stories, I've never referred to somebody unless you are convicted of a crime, like you were convicted of a murder, regardless of your race, you are a convicted murderer. That's who you are. But when you're accused of something, like, you know, a Bridgeport woman, a Bridgeport man, or like, I'll go by the town or the city. I don't think I've ever, in my understanding that, or my recollection, I don't think I've ever referred to, based on their race, people who are suspects in a case. I've never referred to them differently. That's so unbelievable to me. That's crazy.
Yeah. And in part, it's kind of just, like I said, it's kind of just the hyper partisan nature of the news media landscape, where we have these kind of 24-hour news cycles and you have to fill time. And so you kind of just, you get into the mode of presenting things in a way that is going to grab attention quick. Is going to give people kind of a clear understanding. And in giving that understanding, you use shortcuts, or not you, but, you know, media reporters can use shortcuts to say, you know, black man, scary crime. That's the quick narrative, and they can really get attention with that. White man, sympathetic loner. You know, when we're talking about terrorist incidents, Muslim terrorist, whereas, you know, if a white person commits the same kind of acts, they don't get called a terrorist. They get called a troubled individual, and it's about mental health.
Or an attacker or something. Sure.
It is not.
Right.
Exactly. But it's just not the same coverage for every group. And it's really damaging. It colors how we see the world.
It's so interesting. And I think, you know, Spencer, I think you bring up a great topic that people should be very, again, just very aware. And you have to train your mind to pick up on those bias. You know, you have to train your mind to see, okay, this is different than this. And it takes time. But I think once you do have a brain that sees it, it is very blatantly obvious. Very much so.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is such a critical skill. You know, the internet is here to stay. News reporting is never going to go back to kind of the three television stations.
We
have a responsibility to educate ourselves and to be critical about the news that we're reading, because it's just going to get harder to kind of have that objective truth kind of out there.
Mm-hmm. Spencer, we appreciate you bringing this topic to our airwaves. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
People toss this statistic, and I'm putting it in quotation marks, they throw it out all the time, but they don't actually have all the facts and figures. So I just want to give you the latest from the U.S. Census Bureau, saying both marriage and divorce rates in the United States declined from 2009 to 2019. But of course, the rates vary from state to state. So I took a closer look at Connecticut, and we're kind of right in line with the national averages. If you look at Connecticut marriages, we have a 12.4 rating, which means that there are about four fewer marriages per 1,000 women in Connecticut compared to the United States. Our divorce rates are right in line with the national average, where we see a slight decline, but we're around seven marriages out of 1,000 that do end in divorce here in Connecticut versus the United States is 7.6. Why am I telling you this? Well, we like to talk about marriages and why we are seeing either people not getting married or why we're seeing marriages fail. And this morning, there's an interesting question of if faith and marriage go hand in hand. If you don't have faith or you don't have a religion in your life, does that play a role in a failed marriage or even people wanting to get married? So Bob Donovan is back. He's our marriage consultant this morning. Good morning, Bob. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well because I'm not outside freezing right now.
Oh, well, God bless you for that, because it is quite frigid. I got up at 2:30 and I thought, what in the world is happening right now? But, yeah. You know, it's March in New England. What can we say? Snow in March. We've seen it before and we'll see it again. So, Bob, you have a lot of facts and figures here. You got recent data from Gallup, and it talks about church membership versus marriages in the U.S. Can you share a little bit about your research?
Yeah, this is you ever like hear either a podcast or read a book that like you open your eyes and like, whoa, what did I just read here? And I read this book and heard these speakers, and their premise is that our crisis of faith, people walking away from their faith and not attending church, and the crisis of marriage, people not getting married and still high divorce rate, there's a parallel track for the last 50 years. Whoa. So I started digging into this a little bit more, and it is uncanny that these two statistics are tracking, that church membership fell to a record low, first time ever, 47%. Also, the first time ever that we've tracked this is the number of married couples are minority right now. So when you look at the last 50 years, there seems to be a parallel track. So these two Christian researchers started looking into the data. I love your interview earlier with the media expert.
Oh, the
because
media
you talked
bias.
About, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I talked about facts, and I'm looking at facts. I'm not going to get into the why. I could. I have some thoughts, but the facts say there's a connection between the crisis of faith, people walking away from their church and their faith, and the crisis of marriage, people not getting married or still getting divorced at a high level. So they started digging into this and found, they actually concluded that marital breakdown is driving, I call it the flight from faith and church attendance. So they did connect it and found data indicating that is certainly, they've been parallel tracks. So that was the first thing that blew me away. Like, wow.
Interesting. Do you mind me asking this, though, Bob, because I can't help but notice that both of those facts that you threw are from 2020. Do you think the pandemic has anything to do with it? And the reason I ask that is because, for example, like church membership, you know, people went into essentially hiding and just totally, you know, if you could go online, some people didn't do that. And some people pulled away from, you know, just their church communities and having that in their lives. And maybe they even went through loss with COVID or a loss of a job. And a lot of times that's what turns people away from religion. You know, why would God do this to me? Do you think that plays a part, though, in why saw that go down?
It could. I think if that was 2021 data, that may be true. But also, so I think it was 2020. So this was in the middle of that. And typically when it's in the middle of this, it's not like current. It's really, you look at the trend. That's why the other thing would be, Melissa, the trend of this is, if that was an anomaly year, you see what I'm saying? That it was like either increase or flat, and then all of a sudden it plummeted. Well, you're right. but this is a parallel track for 50 years.
But okay. did our numbers go back up for 2021, or did they stay at a record low? I'm wondering.
I think there's a little uptick. I haven't looked at data. I think there's a little uptick, but again, if you look at the trend in 50 years, it's not going to be statistically significant. It really isn't. Mm. It'll be a little higher, my hunch, from 2020 to now.
But that big of a drop. I see what you're saying.
Trending, yeah.
I see what you're
exactly.
saying.
Exactly. Exactly right.
I'm also wondering, too, Bob, I know this is a pure focus on church, but I'm wondering if there's a parallel with any walk of religion, whether you are Buddhist, Muslim, Jewish. I'm wondering if it is parallel, you know, if marriages are breaking down with any kind of a faith, not just Christianity. I'm wondering. I'm curious about that.
Well, again, this data doesn't say evangelical Christians. Mm. It says, again, flight from faith, people walk away from their church, okay? So what's church to people? You have to dig into the data a little bit more. So I'd say it's much more beyond the evangelical community.
Right, that's, your house of worship.
Exactly, because it's more broader than that, okay? Mm-hmm. So, you know, looking at this in a deeper way, again, when they found this parallel, and I'm just now thinking myself, I'm going to be 70 in 2 months, so I've lived through a lot of this, the 60s and 70s and all that. So just my own sense of what's happened, I've seen this in marriage. People not getting married, they don't believe in marriage. The change in divorce laws making it easier to get divorced. So, you know, there's some reasons for this. So, on faith, now, when I worked at BlackRock on Sundays, I would be one of the first people would meet. So I met a lot of new people, a lot. Mm-hmm. And I tell Melissa, like probably 70% of the people I met, I'd say, why are you here? And they would give me a story about they were hurt in their previous church, whatever that was. So I think there's an element of church hurt here as well. So I think there's some legitimate reasons why each one is seeing the statistics they are.
I'm glad you brought that up, Bob, because that was going to be my pushback and I wanted to talk about it, but I think we're in agreement here. So I want to talk about that. In 2014, two Christian researchers initiated a project called the Culture of Freedom Initiative. The purpose of it was to test the connection between healthy marriages and church attendance or following your faith. And we've been talking about it with Bob Donovan, our marriage consultant, this morning. Here's my question, Bob, and I think you started to hint about this before the break. You were saying how a lot of the people you talk to who have come in the front doors of BlackRock Church have said, you know, that they almost felt like they were either judged, not welcomed, or they were burned by their last church. And it's interesting you say that because I won't name who it is, but somebody very close to me who's been in a very long-term relationship, but is growing as a person, is too immature to get married, and is still finding themselves and is just not in a place yet to be married, but has been in this relationship a long time and wants to avoid marriage, has been kind of put down by her partner's church because they're very old school Catholic, which is perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with it. I know there are people who feel very, very strongly about living together before marriage. There are some people who feel that is a horrific sin. It's something you cannot, you can't turn back on. It's just an awful thing. But then there are others who feel, listen, I want to make sure I have a healthy marriage. I want to know I'm going into this with having all the facts in front of me. And we're okay with cohabitating. Isn't that what it's called? So I'm curious if you think that's why some people turn away from the church or if that has an impact on a relationship, because it's for some people, it feels very archaic. It feels like we're still living in a time where, if you go for a walk, unattended, you're sinning with the opposite gender. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, so not digging into that one specific example. I think we did have you and I had a session on that one point a month back. But for the most part, you're right. She's right. She's totally right. Churches have really those types of churches focus on rules and regulations, things you should do and shouldn't do, and become very judgmental. They're totally correct. That is the story I hear from a lot of people that walk through our doors and they find our church. So I'd have to agree with her. That is evidence that I've seen, over the past couple of years. Absolutely. So the answer is yes. Okay. I do want to shift this, because what these two guys did, Van Epp and DeGantz, is absolutely fascinating. So they basically had this hypothesis: faith and marriage are connected. They had data. So then they basically started an initiative in Jacksonville, Florida, and actually did it in Dayton, Ohio, and Phoenix, where they partnered with the community. They brought in some marketing consultants. I mean, they raised some money. I mean, they really attacked this head on. Mm-hmm. They basically found at-risk couples, taught them how to have a healthy relationship by learning skills. They did this across the community. Fascinating. Now, here's the interesting part. And again, this was all data-driven facts, okay? So at the end of this, they found that the Jacksonville community, okay, in the previous 20 years, led Florida in the highest divorce rate. After this initiative of, again, training and educating married couples, and this was extensive, this was across the community, they found the divorce rate to be reduced by 24% in this county, and it became the highest to the lowest in Florida. Okay.
Really?
Now here's the part that blew me away. Remember that number, 24%, the decreased divorce rate. Church attendance. Again, they measured data across this community. Church attendance across this community increased 25 to 30%, almost the same level of the decrease of divorce rate increased in church attendance across the same area.
How interesting.
And they found this in Jacksonville and Phoenix and Dayton. So they've kind of proven this. So that's why this whole thing, like, it's just so interesting, mm-hmm. of how closely connected, again, faith and marriage is.
Mm. I mean, it's super fascinating, I think, for especially people who maybe have fallen off their faith journey, or maybe they don't or they never had one, and that's understandable. I think, you know, as a Christian, which my listeners know I'm a devout Christian, I think the reason I don't find it as shocking, I guess, is because the only way I know for myself. And I'm only speaking for myself. The only reason I'll call myself a decent wife, because I'm certainly far from perfect, but I'll call myself a decent wife
Can I weigh in on that one?
No, you cannot, Bob Donovan. But the only reason I'll call myself decent is because the only reason I know how to really love my husband fully and respect him and do and honor him and do as well as I do for him and vice versa is because I had the example of God's love. That's me personally. So if I didn't have that, I would not be who I am in my marriage. So it makes sense. But I think for the average person, they probably would find that very shocking. That parallel probably would be very shocking for them. Yes.
Yeah. No, you're right. And by the way, I know you well. You're way more than decent. Believe me.
Oh, okay? Shucks.
Let's get that out of the way. Okay.
So
I agree. I totally agree with that, because if you look at kind of the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. it really was, especially the 50s and 60s, it really was a service, self-giving, mm-hmm. selfless generation, right?
Mm-hmm.
What happened from the 70s to 2000s, right?
Well, very selfish.
Exactly.
We're the generation of the selfie, Bob Donovan. We perfected the selfie.
Right?
Yes.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So when you start integrating all this, right, mm-hmm. and integrating your faith into marriage, it totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. What's fascinating with the whole thing is they've statistically proven it. Okay, this is like more than Melissa and Bob like sharing their opinions on this. These guys have data mm-hmm. proving the connection and the parallel between faith and marriage. Okay. Mm-hmm. What's also fascinating is churches now, and not only mine, but I've worked with about five or six different churches, are focusing on getting people back to church. Okay, that's their focus. These guys have flipped the switch. Focus on marriage health, marriage education, marriage strength. If you focus on marriage health, then they will come. That's the interesting part. See, they flipped the switch on how to approach this.
It's interesting. It really is. And Bob, if there are people who want to talk to you about this and maybe making that connection and seeing if this applies to them, how do they contact you directly?
Yeah, that'd be great. So my email would be awesome. It's bdonovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, at blackrock.org.
All right, Bob. Well, very interesting information. Thank you for all your in-depth research and for sharing it with us this morning. Appreciate it.
All right, Melissa.
All right, we'll talk in a couple of weeks. That's Bob Donovan here on WICC.
The latest from the state capitol about your own neighborhood. Connecticut Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff stops by Melissa in the morning. Now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Duff. Thank you so much for being here. How are you? There we go. Senator Duff, are we connected?
How are you? Are we good?
Yes, I can hear you now. Yes. Hi,
okay.
How are you?
Good morning.
No, you're fine.
Good morning.
You're fine. Senator Duff, it's interesting. I got a call from one of our listeners about a week or two back, and she had asked specifically to talk to you about the PROTECT Act and limiting solitary confinement. Now, in my news this morning, we do have an update since this weekend. Excuse me, that in fact an agreement has been reached on language for a bill to create new regulations on solitary confinement in our prisons. What are your thoughts on solitary confinement? Do you feel Connecticut is too harsh? You know, what is sort of your thought on this?
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, probably most of the listeners are, it's not something that many folks think about a lot, but Connecticut has, compared to the rest of the nation, pretty strict penalties or procedures, I guess I should say, on solitary confinement. And so it's been a work in progress over the last few years to try and change that to a certain extent. Not saying that solitary confinement shouldn't happen or that there aren't times where it does need to happen. But I think that those who've been working on the bill over the last few years have thought that, you know, there are some long-term implications of putting people in solitary confinement for a long time. Say, for example, 23 hours a day or 22 hours a day by themselves, and it has, if somebody would ever potentially be released out of prison, that has serious issues with regards to mental health and other types of development. So there's been efforts to try and change that over the years, and it's been very difficult because they're, the corrections officers and those in prison make their arguments. They're those who are in, who advocate for prisoners, who make their argument in trying to find, and then it determines as to when somebody does deserve or should go into solitary confinement. For example, if they start a fight or if there's weapons involved or if it's a harsh crime or, is it and then becomes a staffing issue. And, at the same time where we have fewer corrections officers because of many retirements coming up. So, it's a huge expense. And what does it do to the prisoners and the inmates at the same time? And so trying to work through all of those issues to come up with a policy that that works, that makes sense, and that is fair to everybody, I guess. And so I think that's probably where it takes longer than I think most people would assume it would take in order to kind of get that policy out there. So I'm not involved in drafting of that policy or negotiating the bill or anything else of that. But if there was a compromise struck over the weekend, that would be a good thing because there has been a lot of contention between the correction officers, I would say, those who represent them, and those who advocate for no solitary confinement.
It's an interesting topic, and like you said at the beginning, Senator Duff, I don't think it's something that a lot of people think of unless they themselves have loved ones who are in a corrections center. For example, this listener gave the example that her loved one, was in solitary confinement, I think she said, for over 15 consecutive days, which just, again, unless you're in their shoes and you have a loved one someone who is serving time, and again, I don't know what the crime is. I don't ask those kinds of personal questions, but I do know it's something that matters to some families, not all, but many families in Connecticut.
Right.
And your dogs. Apparently your dogs have something
dog.
To say
I'm
about
it.
No,
just
no,
woke
no.
Her up.
Yeah, listen, you're fine. Listen, it's all good. It's live radio. We're talking this morning with Senator Duff. A couple more minutes with Senator Duff. So we know that this upcoming Friday is the start of the gas tax holiday. And I was curious, Senator Duff, when we had Senator Kelly on last Friday, while I think the gas tax holiday is a great thing, I love that there was bipartisan support, that both sides came together on this. I am wondering, with the sales tax week that we're getting off, I believe it's somewhere in the range of, it's going to cost somewhere around $3 million, I believe.
I would estimate somewhere between 3 and 5.
Okay. Because I had asked Senator Kelly, I said, you know, what's kind of the point of even a week, you know, and why not extend it for more like at least like a month or something? And I didn't know what that dollar amount would be. Like, what would that look like if we extended that?
Well, that's probably, you know, could be, you know, again, between $3 and $5 million a week. So you just multiply that by a month, and it could be that much, you know, that much. You know, it all according to what we could afford for us in the state to run what we need to run government-wise. And but, you know, the decision was made to do a sales tax-free week in order to provide that relief for working families across the state. Now, I would say that the week that we're doing it is an important week because it leads up to the Easter holiday and Passover holiday, and that tends to be a very busy week shopping-wise for retailers. And the reason I know that, it's kind of a crazy thing, but when we were considering building the mall, not that we, but when we were listening to the folks who were interested in developing the mall here in Norwalk, the Sono Collection, we heard from them that the Easter holiday is an extremely busy time for malls and for shopping in general. So I think that it actually the timing of this couldn't be better, because it's already going to be a busy week for retailers. They hopefully will have the added incentive, the fact that there is not going to be sales tax for clothing and footwear under $100, and they can, like they do in August, they can also offer additional sales if they want to bring people in. So I think, in general, I think it'll be a good week, and that it gets people in the stores and it makes people think about it. Sometimes, you know, so I just think that it'll be a win-win for everybody.
That is a good point. I didn't think about the lead up to Easter and Passover, and they are so close this year. It worked out that way. So that's true. I can understand the mindset behind that week being chosen. I guess my question is, in my understanding, and again, this is directly from Senator Kelly, I'm not just making these numbers up and maybe I'm incorrect, but my understanding is the gas tax holiday is going to cost us somewhere around $98 to $100 million, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And he was saying that we here in Connecticut have some $500 million. So that would take about
in
a fifth
surplus?
Of it. Yes.
That could be true. Yeah. Yeah, it all depends, you know, because it depends on what we Yeah, it could be about $500 million. It really depends on what happens. You know, it's all projected right now. So, yeah.
The reason I ask was because, you know, if we did a month of the sales tax week you're talking about, or a sales tax holiday, you're talking about $20 million. So in the grand scheme of things, is that really a big deal, I guess, was what I was getting at.
Yeah, it all depends also what you can get legislative support for, you know, because there's also, if that's the most important thing for folks, then that's the conversation we can have. You know, maybe there's other things we would do, such as bring more funding back to our communities to help with property tax relief, or, you know, other kind of tax cuts like the car tax, or, you know, other means in which we can provide relief, maybe more additional education funding for folks, or funding for higher education or roads or sidewalks or things like that. So I think that's part of the debate as well. I mean, you could always say, you know, sales tax free month or sales tax free week. But I think in general, you know, this is, you could always do more, but, you know, the package that we developed, which sailed through the legislature unanimously, I think was a good start, and was something that will help working families. Again, when it comes to the gas tax holiday and sales tax free week and the free bus service, I think that provides, on balance, you know, something good for the families of the state of Connecticut. And I'm glad that it passed unanimously through the House and the Senate last week.
Mm-hmm. Me too. But it does sound like you guys are still having conversations about ways that we can keep you know, giving relief to taxpayers. It does sound like that's still happening.
Yeah, we've been talking about that for a while. I mean, it's a great position to be in. I think you and I talked about this even back in January when, you know, for years we've had deficits because of we've been funding our pensions that had been underfunded for the, you know, 50 to 70 years. We've been paying those actuarially down, and we've been making extra payments to those things. And we've made two different agreements with state employees that saves $40 billion over 20 years. We've cut our workforce down to 1950 levels on a per capita basis. So I think that, you know, we've earned this position now where we have a better fiscal condition because of the fact that we've made some really tough decisions over the last decade. And so we should be having those conversations about, you know, what kind of relief we can give the residents of the state of Connecticut. You know, I'm a proponent of eliminating the car tax entirely. You know, everybody else has other ideas that, that they would like as well. But we also have to make sure we still fund, you know, services to our communities, and we help with property taxes, other property taxes as well, because we know that those, you know, are like the biggest burden for people are their property taxes on their homes as well. And so that's really important to have. You know, most people, you know, sales tax is a regressive tax, and we could certainly, you know, look at that as an issue to do longer potentially. But when you ask people what the tax that really, you know, frustrates them the most, they will certainly tell you the property tax.
We're chatting this morning with Senator Bob Duff, and we so appreciate you giving us the extra time, Senator Duff. We'll chat with you again next Monday.
All right. Look forward to it. Thank you.
What's going on in the Capitol and how it affects you? State Senator Tony Wong joins Melissa in the morning right now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Senator Wong, thank you for being here. How are you?
I am good. I'm good. Wanted to extend my thoughts and prayers to Al Warren. What a loss. What a wonderful, wonderful person.
But you know what? We were all blessed that we got to have him be part of our lives. We got to listen to him for so many years. And thank you. That's so sweet of you to say that. I appreciate that. Senator Wong, I wanted to talk about a couple of things. As the weather gets a little bit warmer out there, and I know I have focused a lot on restaurants and COVID, especially in recent weeks, and knowing that they were not going to be getting money from the Restaurant Revitalization Program. Is Connecticut extending the outdoor dining for restaurants across the state?
We are, absolutely. In a bipartisan basis, last week, we did extend the executive order for another whole year till April of 2023. And really it is a affirmation that our restaurants, our local restaurant businesses are still struggling. COVID still exists in its many variants. Gratefully, it's less dangerous than it was 2 years ago, but they have struggled. Our restaurants have struggled so much from a standpoint of employees being able to keep businesses open, and the unpredictable roller coaster of this pandemic has severely damaged their business. And, you know, they lost out on Christmas, Valentine's Day, and all the various holidays that drive their business, catering. So what we looked to do was create a safer environment that we would allow you to use outdoor settings, going into using parking lot spaces or outside unused areas. And it really is an important and critical element for them to be able to stay open, have customers come in and feel comfort and not being in an enclosed area. But I also will compliment for us to have gotten this done. Tremendous credit goes to our municipal leaders, because one of the biggest questions is we want to make sure there was a balance between local control and zoning and public safety, that there are considerations that balance with what town administrators and law enforcement. You don't want people taking the outside dining out into a sidewalk, encroaching people's walkway, or maybe even out into the street. That may be dangerous. It's not like New York in some places where some of the street takeover of outdoor dining is able to done where they shut down streets.
Right.
We want to maintain that balance. So a huge credit goes to our municipal leaders and zoning officials and law enforcement to make this work. We're all working together to try to help so many of our businesses, in this case restaurants, overcome the very challenge they've had in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. There's so many other businesses, too, and I think we need to really focus. We're not out of the woods yet.
Not even close.
The economic mm-hmm. revitalization mm-hmm. and inflationary cost and all the tremendous challenges that we're doing. It's got to be something, as we lawmakers deal with policy and all the other issues, it is important for us to keep our eye on the local community businesses that are the real lifeline and the very essence and fabric of our community. Mm-hmm. They don't get enough credit.
Yeah, no question. And you know, and restaurants did definitely get very crafty and creative when they were told they could do kind of an outdoor dining. It was just, what was that going to look like? So it's good to know that's being extended, and it certainly should help that industry a little bit for sure. I also wanted to talk before we run out of time, Senator Huang, about I guess there was a town hall career reentry presentation. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. I reached out to Career Resources, Scott Wilderman, that's based in Bridgeport, and they help in supporting people that have been formerly incarcerated with reentry in a second chance society. And it coincided with them submitting doing a comprehensive analysis of reentry, the demographics and the implications, and some of the data points. It's a tremendous report. For those that want to find out more, you can go to the reentry website. But what was interesting was you hear so much about crime and punishment in mm-hmm. the news in regards to particularly juvenile justice. One of the important parts is not looking at just punishment, but looking at prevention of these kind of reoccurring crimes. When you look at recidivism of people going back into prison, that occurs over 45% within the first year of people who have paid their debt to society incarceration. There is a remarkable challenge in regards to that. Another important part that we looked at in having our conversation was about counseling. There's a program that we funded in the state that takes previously incarcerated program directors and counselors, and they go into the prisons to help these individuals with counseling, shared experiences. They call them credible counselors because they've lived the life and experience, and hopefully they'll be able to reiterate to them the challenges and the opportunities they will have and be able to anticipate. The third component we talked about was really diversionary. Juvenile justice is real. It's a challenge either caused by COVID, by systemic system errors or omissions. What we looked at is looking at prevention programs, mm-hmm. diversionary programs in regards to counseling, mentoring. And you just talked earlier this morning about Wakeman opening up a new Boys and Girls
yes,
Club.
Yes, in Bridgeport.
It's important that we support these kind of programs, the Cardinal Sheehan's, the McGivney's, the Wakeman Burroughs, and now this new organization, new entity in Madison. Look, kids need activities. And when you have those after-school programs that engage in athletics, engage in mentoring, engage in educational extension opportunities, these opportunities keep kids out of trouble. I can share that exactly for me. I was one of those beneficial kids, Melissa, mm-hmm. that if I didn't have these kind of supportive programs, I could have gotten into trouble. And it's not just any community, any demographic. Kids are high energy. They get bored easily. Mm-hmm. But if you have these programs where there's mentoring, and there's a theme here, right?
Yeah.
Mentoring, supportive services, programs to keep kids engaged. That's the way you keep them from getting into troublemaking and criminal activities.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we need to look at prevention as well as looking at attacking these issues. We mm-hmm. need to attack it all. But you know, as I said many times on your show, we have to address it as a problem.
Right.
And when it's a problem, then you're willing to do things. But you can't just look at punishment as one means of prevention. You've got to look at prevention, diversion, and supportive services to keep those kids from going down that path.
Right,
that was the program idea, and I hope we were able to get some really good ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Senator Huang, we appreciate you talking about all these different topics here on the show, and we'll check back in with you next week.
Thank you. Have a great week.
Thank you. You too, Senator Huang.